Hello, it is Tuesday, the 23rd of June. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. In a parliamentary hearing, ruling and opposition lawmakers spoke in unison as they reprimanded election officials for the ballot paper shortages on the June 3rd local elections. More on that shortly. For our in-depth, more and more are deciding to forego life-sustaining treatment at the end of life, and many want to make that decision for themselves. We'll have a medical ethics expert join us. Plus, on Hallyu Highlights, we will talk about the awards, a concert in Busan, and a rather somber anniversary. All that and more on Korea 24.
(목소리도) 판사, 변호사, 뭐 교수님들 뭐 하는데 이 사람도 한 일이 뭐예요?
예.
의사결정 예. 과정 중 내용들을 예. 알아야 우리가 조치를 예. 할 수 있는데 지금 전혀 안 되고 있는 부분이
예. 전영 의원님 말씀.
긴급.
예. 서범수 간사. 예.
아까 우리 성파구의 어느 분이 그러셨죠? 민소영.
Lawmakers grilled current and former election officials over the June 3rd ballot shortages as a parliamentary investigation gets underway. The National Election Commission delivered its briefing at a National Assembly on Tuesday during a plenary session of a special committee in charge of the inquiry. For more on this and other major headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-kyung. Hello, In-kyung.
Hello, Andrew.
The National Assembly formed a special committee to investigate the ballot shortages, and the 45-day mandate began today with a briefing from the National Election Commission. As we just heard, lawmakers berated NEC officials, and the criticism crossed party lines. In-kyung, can you tell us more?
Sure. Ruling and opposition party lawmakers slammed election officials for the ballot paper shortages and for their failure to properly respond to the situation. The NEC's own fact-finding committee believes more than 30 people were unable to cast ballots on election day, as voting was suspended at a total of 26 polling stations, mostly in Seoul's Songpa district. Many were eventually able to vote, but only after exit poll results were announced. Because former NEC chief Noh Tae-hak resigned in the aftermath of the incident, acting chair Lee Chul-ran apologized again for what happened. Let's listen to him speak.
2022년 대선 사전투표 부실 관리 논란 이후
We're devastated and heartbroken that despite our various efforts over the past 4 years to restore public trust following the controversy over the poor management of early voting in the 2022 presidential election, this has happened again due to our inadequate preparation and response to election management. Not even a single person's right to vote should be infringed, but we fail to fulfill our constitutional duty. As a public official responsible for election management, I deeply regret this and feel a profound sense of responsibility.
Lawmakers at the hearing said the Election Commission suffers from structural problems. What do they mean?
They point out that many of the commissioners serve as non-standing members of the NEC while working as full-time judges. Noh Tae-hak is also a Supreme Court justice. He said at today's parliamentary hearing that he thinks it is no longer possible to maintain the current system where the chairperson holds a non-permanent post. Since its founding in 1963, a Supreme Court justice has concurrently served as the chief of the NEC, and this structure has been blamed for lack of control and management within the election body.
In other headlines, the KOSPI plunged nearly 10% on Tuesday, closing just above the 8,200 level. The index has been on a roller coaster, but the 910-point fall was the largest single-day point drop in the KOSPI's history. In-kyung, can you tell us what happened?
Sure. The index finished at 8,203.84, tumbling 9.99% from Monday. It opened down 0.34% and briefly attempted to rebound, but soon reversed course and fell sharply throughout the day. The downturn triggered a sell-side sidecar at 11:40 a.m., suspending program sell orders for 5 minutes, and then a circuit breaker at 2:33 p.m., suspending trading for 20 minutes. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also plunged almost 8% to close below the 900 mark at 891.52.
What drove the collapse?
It was led by overnight losses in U.S. technology stocks and concerns of a rate hike by the Fed. Bank of America said Monday that it expects the Fed to increase rates by 25 basis points each in September, October, and December. It's the most aggressive rate hike projection among global brokerages, and it drove up bond yields and froze investor sentiment. Profit-taking was also a big factor.
North Korea has reasserted its plans to expand its nuclear arsenal and reaffirmed its policy categorizing South Korea as the, quote, the most hostile state. In-young, what can you tell us?
According to the North state-run Korean Central News Agency on Tuesday, regime leader Kim Jong-un presided over the second plenary meeting of the ruling Workers' Party's 9th Central Committee for 3 days beginning Saturday. The session was held to check the progressive decisions made at the 9th Party Congress in February. The KCNA said the meeting emphasized Pyongyang's commitment to the expansion of nuclear forces, the thorough exercise of its status as a nuclear weapon state, and the expedited implementation of more extensive, innovative, and encouraging plans for its nuclear technology. Kim issued the instructions to proceed with projects designed to increase the North's powerful defense assets without pause, emphasizing the country's autonomy and its goal of overwhelming the world. Pyongyang also slammed Seoul and Washington's military alliance, including the Nuclear Consultative Group on Nuclear Deterrence and Seoul's push to build its own nuclear submarines.
Moving to the situation in the Middle East, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance reiterated his claim that Iran has agreed to allow nuclear inspectors back into the country after the first round of high-level negotiations between the two countries that concluded in Switzerland on Monday. In-young, can you tell us more?
Vance said Iran agreed to invite International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors back into the country. He said discussions with the IAEA will take place this week, maybe as soon as Monday. Under the U.S.-Iran MOU, Iran's highly enriched uranium stockpile will undergo dilution, also known as downblending, to lower its purity directly in the field under the supervision of the IAEA. But the specific technical mechanism, exact timelines, and final disposal method remain subject to further negotiation.
And what is the latest regarding passage through the Strait of Hormuz?
Iran and Oman's foreign ministers met to discuss the matter, and Omani Foreign Minister Badr bin Hamad al-Busaidi said the two sides affirmed the commitment to international law and toll-free safe passage. He said the talks centered on the MOU between the U.S. and Iran, especially the Strait of Hormuz paragraph. That paragraph says Iran will facilitate safe transit for commercial vessels in the waterway at no charge for 60 days. But there's growing speculation that Iran will charge an insurance fee for vessels passing through the strait after the 60-day period.
The Ministry of Data and Statistics released the findings on Tuesday of the 2024 National Time Transfer Accounts, which incorporate data on unpaid caregiving and domestic services within households. What is this all about?
The data showed that men's household labor output increased by 35% over the five-year period ending in 2024, but women's labor still accounted for 73% of total unpaid domestic work. The report showed that women's share of the housework and childcare burden, such as cleaning and parenting, continues into old age, up to around age 84. It also found that when the burden of housework is at its peak, women perform 7.7 times more domestic labor than men. The national time transfer accounts measure unpaid household labor that is not included in the gross domestic product, tracking its production, consumption, and intergenerational transfer by age and gender. It was newly approved as an official set of national statistics this year and compares the years 2019 and 2024.
That's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, Inge.
Thanks, Andrew.
We are Boys Choir Bonipueri, and you are now listening to
Korea 24.
Futile life-sustaining treatment is a term used in medical ethics to refer to procedures like CPR or dialysis that don't improve the health condition of a terminal patient, but only prolong the dying process. According to the National Agency for Management of Life-Sustaining Treatment, decisions to forego life-sustaining treatment at the end of life have now surpassed 500,000 cumulative cases since the system began 8 years ago in 2018. These decisions are made either through the patient's own documented wishes or by family members or a legal guardian on their behalf. So far, decisions made through family members have outnumbered those made by patients themselves, but the share of decisions based on the patient's own wishes have been climbing, recently passing the halfway mark for the first time. Accordingly, the Ministry of Health and Welfare is working to raise the rate of self-determination up to 56.2% by 2028, and also have plans to facilitate the process by allowing online submissions next year. To discuss this in more in-depth, we're joined in the studio by Professor Lee Il-hak of the Department of Medical Law and Ethics at Yonsei University College of Medicine. Professor Lee, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The issue of foregoing futile life-sustaining treatment is especially pressing in a rapidly aging society like Korea. As I mentioned, we've now passed 500,000 cases since the system began in 2018, with nearly 8,000 cases in April alone this year. As someone who has studied the system from the very start, what's your take on these numbers? What do the numbers tell us?
Right from the start, people have wanted a way to sort out their wishes for end-of-life care and to know they will be followed. 500,000 people now have their end-of-life wishes respected. That is a massive step forward. But I think we have to look at this number quite differently. Just imagine the number of cases we see every single year. At roughly 250,000 cases annually, it means that the system is only working for about a fifth of the people who need it. It's brilliant to celebrate how far we've come, but there is still so much more that needs sorting out.
So one-fifth, that is a smaller-than-hoped number. Of all cases so far, decisions made based on family testimony account for 159,852 cases, or around 32%, and decisions based on a predetermined treatment plan account for another 32%. Decisions made by a legal guardian or family members come next at 24.1%, while decisions based on the patient's own advance directive make up just 12.1%. So these decisions have been made through family members far more often than by the patients themselves. You're a medical ethics expert. What is the direction that we should be moving towards regarding foregoing life-sustaining treatment? Should we be moving towards a more, quote, self-determination route? And if so, why?
Self-determination is very ideal by its concept, but we need to take a more realistic view of self-determination. Self-determination has conditions to be fulfilled before it is followed or respected. Allowing a sign of form is not protecting self-determination. It's just beginning. If it is far more effective and arguably more ethical to help people understand and articulate what they truly matters to them, the best way forward is not just saying self-determination, but prepare a system or change our attitude toward the dying people. It's something we can call a shared approach. Decisions should be made together and communicated clearly so that they can be respected when the time has come. The idea of self-determination should be interpreted in the clinical context. We need to look at the self-determination through a clinical lens. Ultimately, it means giving people the respect and support they need in later life, particularly at the very end. So we have to think about care of them and respecting them. And to my mind, the best way to show that respect is just to ask, what do you think? So in many countries, the end-of-life decision-making is called a conversation.
Well, It's a very difficult decision. And although self-determination is the ideal, you nicely pointed out that it's an ideal that is difficult to reach in most cases. The rate of self-determination has now passed the halfway mark in recent years, which is, I guess, a positive development. First exceeding 50% in 2024, then rising to 52.2% last year and 52.9% last month. But we've also seen reporting on families overriding a patient's signed advance directive in real emergency situations, choosing to continue treatment out of guilt or shock, which is to some extent understandable, even when the patient has clearly stated otherwise. As a doctor, Professor Lee, can you tell us more about this type of situation? What do you think is the right thing to do, if there is a right thing to do?
Oh, the first thing is I want to emphasize the conversation. It is a communication between people, everyone involved, like patient and the doctors and the family members. So in many cases, especially at the very end of life, people losing their capacity to express their wishes. So family members have to witness what's the real preferences of the patient. So if the family doesn't know what is the real preference of a patient, is very difficult. So they are moving toward the social convention of the caring, something in Korean convention or tradition, something we call hyo. So sometimes hyo is interpreted as doing anything possible. So it is very unwise or unbeneficial to the patient. And as for the percent, like 50-something, I am sorry to say, but statistics can sometimes be deceptive. A figure like 50% sounds impressive, but it only accounts about 20% of all cases I mentioned. In all honesty, we must admit that we don't know exactly what is happening in the hospitals at the very end of life. Clearly. So all dying is individual, so we have to approach this end of life individually. The textbook approach to end of life care tells us to include family members. I believe that feeling of guilt can never be entirely prevented, even with the best possible care. But what we can do is remove the obstacles to emotional recovery. One way to achieve this is through conversation, sharing gratitude, offering forgiveness, and deciding together how to face the end with dignity.
Let's talk about the advance directive form itself. The Korean version is just 2 pages, which I've read and noticed is quite simple and very short when compared to, for example, California's, which runs around 10 pages and asks patients to weigh values like living longer versus living comfortably. I actually have 2 forms with me here. And compared to the Korean form, the Californian form, first of all, is much longer. It has colorful pictures. The wordings are different. The questions are much more detailed. If you look back, it says, what matters most in life? Quality of life differs for each person. What is important to you? What is your opinion, Professor Lee, on the form in Korea, and what would an ideal version of the form look like?
The better side of the simple form is it could work as a sign or starting point. The patient leaves something, and then the family and the healthcare professional can discuss about it. And usually, the documentation itself means that patient doesn't want life-sustaining treatment, but it is not enough. And also, it is very insufficient. I must confess, I feel somewhat responsible for this mess. I'm one of the people who made it. So the revision process has just begun, so I cannot predict exactly what the revised advanced directives will look like. But I want to emphasize one crucial point. A document is a result of a conversation, not the purpose of it. All the increase in registered directives, the easier way to document them is certainly a positive step. However, this should not distract us from our true aim. The aim is better care for the dying person. I believe we can and will improve the document, but crucially, at the same time, we must work on process itself. How make it easier for the dying patient to express their way, and or without any fear or guilt feeling, to tell their children about their wishes or what they really want about their care.
There is also a new plan underway, which Professor Lee mentioned just now, where people will be able to prepare and register advance directives online, regardless of time or location. Right now, the form must be filled out after an in-person consultation. Professor Lee, what are your thoughts on the idea of online registrations?
We have to think about the digital divide. Older generations always bring their smartphone with them, but actually they don't know how to use it. Sometimes we can see an older generation who is at a loss at in front of a kiosk, how to use them, what does it mean in the screen. Even sometimes they don't know which is it meant to be pressed. So if we make it the online version of the advanced directive, it could reach some other possible group of people, not the elderly people. So yes, the online version of the advanced directive is a good starting point, especially the people who has not enough time or chance to think about their end of life. So it could be a younger generation who doesn't have enough time to visit the registration offices or something in person. So it could be very helpful, but as I mentioned, it is very difficult. The situation is somewhat different with the elderly dying patient who is very sick and who lowers their capacity or who is very difficult to express their wishes very strongly to the children. So we need another step or something we can support these people. So it's something process I mentioned.
With growing calls for self-determination, that is making your own call on whether to forego life-sustaining treatment, the Ministry of Health and Welfare is working to raise the rate of self-determination up to 56.2% by 2028. Professor Lee, what is your opinion on the goal?
The 50% of the self-determination means that among the people who utilize the end-of-life decision system, not everyone who are dying in the hospitals or at home. So this is one point I want to mention. And I certainly hope this goal is achieved, I hope, truly. There is a national plan for better end-of-life care that encompasses a broad range of measures. It includes public campaigns, professional education, the integration of care systems, and financial and administrative support for the providers. However, this is a multi-dimensional issue, not a single issue like healthcare or the elderly care. It touches upon our medical, social welfare, cultural, and educational environment. Because ultimately, death and dying is never simply a medical issue. So governmental, the aim or the goal can be achieved with this somehow integrated or total approach to these issues.
So while we have you here, I'd also like to expand our discussion to this end-of-life care, which I guess touches on this point about patients wanting this smoother and less painful way out. So even when a patient and family agree to stop life-sustaining treatment, KBS reporting found there's often nowhere for them to go. Hospice beds are scarce and concentrated in the Seoul metro area. Cost, again, is a very major barrier. According to 2025 data from the Bank of Korea, terminally ill patients on life-sustaining treatment spent over 10 million won, which is around $6,500 US at current exchange rates, on medical care in the final year of life. That figure is double what it was a decade earlier, roughly that is, and equal to roughly 40% of the median income for households aged 65 and older. In other words, it's a lot of money. So if this cost trend continues, health insurance spending on life-sustaining treatment is projected to surge from 3 trillion won in 2030 to 16.9 trillion won by 2070. So that's five times what is expected to be spent in 2030. So given all this, Professor Lee, how do you think end-of-life care can be made more accessible, especially, again, regarding the costs?
Economic considerations are, of course, part of the end-of-life care discourse. as the other area of social care, we must prepare for the ramification of the aging society. And I expect my economist colleagues will devise some brilliant solutions for this. Yes, but we have to think about our own solutions, our opinions about this. However, the issue of end-of-life care, which economical interests are projected, so it is a beginning of our story. So some people think the hospice saves money and hospice can be more effective or efficient way of spending money at the end of life. But if we think in this way, there is some misleading point in our consideration of end-of-life care. In the beginning, everyone has a right to decent health care, whatever the conditions may be. And we must remember that good palliative care also costs money. Actually, it doesn't save money very much. There is some considerations about this. Therefore, we need to divide the conversation about expenses in two parts. One part is saving money by stopping unnecessary or futile medical treatments. The other is increasing the services available for dying patients wherever they are or whatever their conditions are. So I'm afraid that increasing service will not be very cheap. So we have to prepare ourselves, or we have to open the possibility we could spend more. Mm-hmm. If we increase this hospice, because nowadays even the providing the government hospice palliative care program have some financial difficulties. If we approach the end of life care issues expecting to simply save money, we surely be disappointed.
So it sounds like the cost dynamics is somewhat inevitable to a certain extent. But under current law, treatment can only be withdrawn once a patient enters the legally defined dying process, not the earlier terminal stage. These are, I guess, legal niceties that divide the stages in which these patients have to go through before passing on. But a government survey found 82% of medical society representatives support moving that threshold earlier to the terminal stage. So what are your thoughts on this particular wording? And should this be something that is considered going forward?
Mm-hmm. Speaking as a medical ethicist, I believe the current legal clause like dying process is rather exceptional compared to other countries. The concept of a dying process served as a necessary compromise between different views by the time of legislation. Some people were not very open to the possibility of legislation, and some people are very eager to make on legislation. So there was some crash between these perspectives. So we need a compromise. So dying process is very, very clear, and there is no doubt about it. So it is a compromise, a negotiation point at the time of legislation. But now, as those legal boundaries are shifting, and people's experience and understanding are changing. So it's the result of the professional survey about the moving or removal of a dying process in the legislation. Mm-hmm. So, but by this shift, a new challenge arises, I think. Expanding the condition under which end-of-life care decisions are implemented places a heavy burden on clinicians. They have to be responsible for what is happening to the patient. But because dying process is very clear and the people will die within days. So there is not very much to consider in the care of the dying patient. But terminal usually means several months, even a year. So anything can happen in between. So the physicians or clinicians bear some burdens. They will bear immense responsibility in their clinical judgment and also for their ethical decision makings. This brings us to the broader concept of advanced care planning. And now many people in South Korea is thinking about the advanced care planning. Mm-hmm. It is an approach that covers a much wider range of patients, longer time frames, and varied medical interventions. So it even includes the the places to live at the end of life, and even some kind of the funerals or even organ donations after their death. Mm-hmm. So I expect this new approach of the advanced care planning will be a topic of medical and ethical societies for the coming years. I found that many professionals in medicine and ethics societies already are aware about this advanced care planning, and they agree with the ideas. But we are stuck at some point how to implement it and how can we get support from the government or from the general public. Mm. So currently we are thinking about way of providing these materials or some kind of the financial or the support from the government. So it is now beginning. So let's see what will happen.
Mm. So I guess it makes sense, though, to include the conversation from the terminal stage, because it gives you months and possibly even more than a year to discuss all the emotionally and financially fraught decision of whether or not to continue treatment. So, but that's all for today's in-depth news analysis. That was Professor Yi-Hu Hak from the Yonsei University College of Medicine. Professor Lee, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index plunged 910.71 points, or 9.99% on Tuesday, to close at 8,203.84. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 76.88 points, or 7.94%, to close at 891.52. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
South Korean pianist Im Yun-chan won Germany's highest award for classical music Monday, local time. What you are hearing now is the aria from Bach's Goldberg Variations, performed by Im Yun-chan, which earned him the prestigious honor. For this and other widely viewed stories in Korea for our Korea Trending segment, we are joined by Daniel Che. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Andrew.
So, Daniel, Im Yun-chan is arguably the hottest Korean pianist. Tell us more about his latest win.
Sure thing. According to the German Association for the Promotion of Classical Music, Im Yun-chan won Instrumentalist of the Year at the Opus Classic, meaning he received Germany's highest award for classical music this year. This marks the second consecutive year as South Korean pianist has claimed the title. Cho Sang-jin's win last year for his recording of Ravel the Complete Solo Piano Works was the one that made headlines previously.
I imagine the competition to win this was tough, to say the least. How tough was this?
Well, he was up against only about 680 recordings and projects there submitted to the awarding body. Im's latest release in February, J.S. Bach Goldberg Variation, beat out the rest to deliver him this prestigious honor.
Feels like it hasn't been that long since Im Yun-chan made headlines for nabbing prestigious international awards. Can you walk us back to some of his previous wins?
Well, all Im does is win, 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 apparently. He has a long list of musical achievements. Just last year, he bagged 3 BBC Music Magazine Awards, including Recording of the Year. Some of the standout accomplishments include the 2024 win at the Gramophone Awards for Chopin Etudes, a first for a South Korean pianist. The award ceremony and gala event will be held on October 10th and 11th at the Konzerthaus Berlin, Germany. And next month, Im is set to perform as a soloist at the Ravinia Festival held in Highland Park, Illinois, over in the U.S.
Congratulations again to Im Yun-chan. But moving on to our next story. Dan, what do you have?
South Korea's mobile app map service, Kakao Map, has got people talking online as it provides details of several locations across the border in North Korea.
Certainly something that would grab attention of those curious about the reclusive regime, which I should say are many. And I might know the answer to this next question, but what parts or facilities were prominently featured?
According to various online posts by users that popped up on Monday, the map services show a number of North Korean locations, some of the standout being Kim Il-sung University, Pyongyang University of Education, both located in the capital city of Pyongyang. Not only that, it also showed several train stations.
I know that you kind of get glimpses on Google Earth because the images there are satellite imagery. Have there been other major map services, though, that provide such details about North Korea?
Well, the other major map service operated by rival tech firm Naver have not and still does not display places within North Korea in such detail. No access to exact location of specific facilities such as hospitals or universities. Only prominent geographical features such as mountains and bridges can be seen.
So I guess I have to ask, how and why does Kakao provide such details up north of our border?
Apparently, both tech firms claim they have limited users from searching for locations and location details, rather, in the north. The key difference is the Naver map is developed mainly based on OpenStreetMap, while Kakao utilizes other geographic data, including data provided by Korea's state-run National Geographic Information Institute. As a result, when users manually pan the Kakao map, they can get details of certain facilities and structures.
So I'm actually going to check that out after today's show, but we have to go to our final story before I do that. What do you have, Dan?
There's been a rising number of cases involving attempts to smuggle in obesity medicines into Korea.
I knew they were popular, but I didn't know they were that popular. Tell us more.
Well, according to data provided by the Korea Customs Service, by May, the number of cases of attempts to bring obesity drugs like Mounjaro into the country through Incheon International Airport reached nearly 290 this year alone, a huge spike compared to less than 90 recorded between last September and December. Attempts to import the drugs through international mail have also shot up. Between January and May, more than 2,900 cases detected, marking a near threefold on-year spike, with most of the drugs being purchased and brought in from Japan and India. Some online communities can be seen using terms like sushi jaro and India jaro.
Well, I'm not an expert, but if there's smuggling going on, obviously there's demand. Where is this increased demand coming from in Korea?
So it is apparently way more expensive here in Korea compared to many other countries around the world. Even at some of the cheapest clinics in Seoul, a four-week supply of 2.5 milligram dose costs 290,000 won. That's over $188. In Japan, the same supply costs around a quarter of that amount. Some people who travel overseas just to buy the drug wrote on an online community that the money saved by buying and bringing in even 1 month's supply more than covers the cost of the flight itself.
So what comes next for authorities in Korea? Do we try to reduce smuggling? If so, how? Is it going to be lower prices? What can you tell us?
So for now, authorities are being criticized for stepping up custom enforcement and strengthening oversight of illegal import and distribution instead of offering solutions to reduce costs. Some experts say the government need to take a comprehensive look at domestic pricing burdens, prescription management systems, and even consider broader national health insurance coverage to improve access to the drug is needed, as obesity is a chronic disease that causes a range of complications. We did cover in our previous edition that the government is reviewing measures to include baldness or hair loss medication in national health coverage, insurance coverage. One of the reasons why prices are lower in Japan is that the country includes the obesity drugs in its national health insurance pricing framework, which allows the government to manage the price.
That's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us all the stories, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome to this week's edition of Hallyu Highlights, your weekly scoop on everything hot in Korean entertainment, from the latest K-pop hits to the K-dramas. Everyone's binging, and as usual, we are joined in the studio today by our resident K-culture expert, Bernie Cho. Bernie, great to have you here again.
Always good to be back.
Our first story today concerns the Grammy Awards and its expansion. This is a topic we briefly discussed in our Korea Trending segment last week. The Grammy Awards will add five new categories next year, with one category in particular, Best Asian Pop Music Performance, the source of a lot of discussion and a whole lot of debate. Bernie, what's the significance of this award and what is this controversy?
Well, you know, it's I think it's safe to say long overdue that finally Asian pop music is finally getting recognition and hopefully somebody very deserving early next year will get their flowers. Now, what could have should have been basically a very decisive decision that people should have been applauding has not just been the focus of discussion, debate, and a bit of controversy. Because, look, I think it's great that finally Asian pop music is being recognized so that you'll have the best of the best from East Asia, from Japan, Greater China region, and Korea represented. But the thing that is vague is what is considered Asia. Do you count South Asia, music from India, music from Southeast Asia? Possibly, maybe, yes. Now, I think Asian pop as a category is accurate because I did the math. Of the top 20 best-selling K-pop songs or, you know, most streamed K-pop songs, or for that matter, the top K-pop artists, anywhere between 75 to upwards of 80% of the top 20, based on last year's data, were what I would consider Asian diaspora artists, whether they happen to be overseas Koreans, but more and more now, non-Korean, often Asian, obviously non-Korean passport holding members. That's become more the rule and less the exception. So in many ways, if a K-pop act were to win, Asian pop is probably going to be more accurate. Now, when this was announced initially, originally, there were a lot of people who immediately said, oh, finally, BTS is going to easily win a Grammy. Look, right now, over the past few days, BTS obviously sold out World Tour. They're going to be coming up soon for the World Cup. But they also have another thing going for them, which is their album, Arirang, is currently considered right now among many media outlets around the world one of the best albums of 2026 so far. Problem, many of the singles that they've released, which have gone on to become not just local, regional, but global hits, would not qualify for this particular new Grammy category. And so a lot of fans are going, wait a minute. Is this new category going to help, or is it it might actually hurt? Because, look, there are two criteria that this particular category has. One, they're going to check that box off. It has to be from a band with a song that originates and is popular across Asia. Check. The problem that arises is language. Unlike Latin music or the Latin Grammys, all eligible songs need to be at least 60% of its lyrics in Spanish or Portuguese or any language from Latin America to qualify. The Grammys for this new category made it very vague. And I quote, because I can't make this up and I don't want to be misquoted. An Asian language should play a significant role within the song in bilingual or multilingual structures such that the recording is identifiable with that language. Problem.
Sounds like legal language almost.
It kind of sort of does. Problem is many of the biggest K-pop hits are predominantly or mostly in English in order to cross over, break out, break through. So this criteria ends up handicapping a lot of the biggest K-pop songs that have come out and have been nominated. And so it really is a curveball instead of a home run for a lot of these aspiring wannabe Grammy hopefuls. And so, again, a lot of debate online, and some people have gone so far as to say that creating this category is a way of sort of getting K-pop out of a lot of the mainstream categories and just putting them in
That's
the corner.
That's what I was thinking.
Putting them in the box, and you know what? Song of the year, album of the year, artist of the year. No, you're not there yet. Although you're on the list, we're just going to give you the consolation prize, K-pop. And so when looking at other major award show, whether it's the American Music Award Show, or the Billboard Music Award Show, or the MTV Video Music Award Show, all of them now have K-pop categories. But all of these award shows also have K-pop songs and albums and artists winning the major categories. the Grammys right now stands out and sticks out in the way that it looks like Asian or K-pop stars will continue to have a hard time in the main categories, but they're going to have a hard time in the category that was kind of sort of designed for Asian artists. So
that's weird.
It's a real dilemma. Mm. And so, again, this is trending. This debate will not die down. But the fact that they left the language thing incredibly vague is up to a lot of debate. So we shall see. I think this subject we're going to come back to again.
Do you think it's possible to change that in the near future? Or,
well, look, truth be told, and, you know, for full disclosure, so I have friends who happen to be involved, who happen to be voting members of the Grammy. And this is something that, you know, they've been working on for years. And the Grammy Awards are very cognizant of the importance and the impact and influence of K-pop music, now J-pop music, and obviously artists who happen to be Asian. Try to do the right thing. And I just wonder if they overthought it or didn't think enough. I really don't know. Mm. But like any other award show, and in this case, you know, some of the, even the new categories are reworked previous categories. I think there's room for improvement, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's going to be a little bit of fine tuning before the big day arrives in early 2027, I believe, February. Mm. So we need to be on the lookout between now and then. But yeah, this needs a little bit of fine tuning.
So hopefully practice will make perfect. But for our next story, we go to Busan, a city known for summer fun, outdoor music festivals. Today, we're going to be talking about the Busan One Asia Festival, slated to celebrate its 10th anniversary this coming week on June 27th, June 28th at, of course, again, Busan. Busan ASEAN Main Stadium, to be exact. And the two-day weekend lineup is jam-packed with K-pop stars. And you're going to tell us who they are, right?
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting is I can't believe it's already been 10 years. It almost feels like yesterday when they first launched this particular festival, One Asia Festival. Now, this particular event is actually, although you feel like it might be one day, 2 days, it's actually 3 days. It's not over one weekend. It's over two weekends. We got to give a little love for the version called the Park Concert, which is going to be held, which was held a few days ago on the 20th. And this was held at, I believe, at the Echo Park that is in Busan. And that's sort of kind of like an appetizer to the big event, the main event at the stadium that you just mentioned, at the Busan ASEAN Main Stadium. Now, on the 27th and 28th, which is just around the corner, what really surprised me was Busan announced this lineup incredibly late. They announced this on the 17th, and then the first show was on the 20th, and then we have the next shows right around the corner on the 27th, 28th. But you know what? As they say, better late than never. And some of the big names that are going to be performing. So on the 27th, Akmu, also known as the Akdong Musicians. Again, some of these names I have to just clarify because at first you have no idea. Are they a real band? What are you talking about? So one of the bands we should know or acts is You Know. Mm. Obviously, you don't know. Now you know. I had to go there. Treasure, always, you know, going to be a big act. Kiki, Hitan from NCT. And then not to be confused with NCT, but a band called NXT. Mm. But the second day has some really interesting artists because they have Rise, R-I-I-Z-E. And again, and another of these really interesting names, spelled ident as an identity, but we now know what their identity is. It's ident. Lee Young-ji, who's really hot right now. Kickflip, incredibly hot. Hearts to Hearts, Kim So-hee, Triple S. And Evan, who is a breakout, breakthrough band member, former band member of Enhypen. He will start his solo activities at this particular stage. This is a big event, and it's got a lot of the best and brightest new acts, mostly headlining. And so, and again, the weather looks like it's going to be absolutely fantastic. And what I noticed too, the dates, 27th, 28th, it does not conflict or coincide or collide with the World Cup games. Mm. So yes, no sacrifice needed to get a little fun and sun down in Busan.
That's it for today's Hallyu Highlights. Thanks for joining us in the studio again.
All good. Thank you.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back tomorrow. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio on air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
KBS World Radio.